It's Wednesday, November 29, 2023, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me today are my colleagues, Jared Schroeder and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, remembering former First Lady Rosalynn Carter and the impact that she had on the mental health advocacy reporting, the journalists who cover that space and the work that they encounter on a daily basis. We're also going to talk about why comedian Sarah Silverman is at the center of the debate over copyright and AI and police scanners. Sure, they're not something that everyone listens to on the regular, but some departments are trying to limit the public's access. We'll talk about why and why that's not such a good thing. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up, but we're going to start with the mess at Sports Illustrated. Once upon a time, it was among the best in sports reporting. Well, Monday, it deleted a whole swath of articles from its website after the publication Futurism reported that it had discovered that Sports Illustrated had published several stories under fake bylines. They were characters who were made up with a name and a face plastered on the content that was published, generated by AI. Now, we've talked about these failed experiments before, the idea of misplaced cliches in articles or issues of potential plagiarism as stories were scraped together. But this was different. This was passed off as written by a person and a person who doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's crazy. I kind of looked at it and in some ways, I'm really not surprised.
I mean, somebody was going to try this at some point.
Yeah, somebody was going to try it whole cloth. I mean, right. We talked about this a lot ever since ChatGPT hit the market. And
Just about a year ago.
Yeah, what some of the issues were going to be. And we saw some of that from AP reporting and that sort of thing. But this is just, you know, they made up the reporters. They made up the bios of the reporters.
They purchased headshots from stock image sites. Also generated
by
AI.
And then the thing that bothered me was that they didn't even own up to it. They figured that if we just take it off the website, then it would just sort of like go away. But the funny thing happened is that they take one off and then replace it with another. It was just the craziest thing. And I'm like, why are you doing this? Especially for Sports Illustrated. I understand that, you know, it was bought several years ago by another company. It's not owned by a legacy media operation as it once was, but it is still Sports Illustrated.
And they're still cashing in on that brand that carries that legacy. And that's one of the things that's really troublesome about this to me. And Jared, I'd be interested in your take on this, that idea of the social contract we have with our audiences and how this really does move from automating some tasks to free up human brain power for more intensive work. This was literally meant to cut the corner, deceive, and not really care about it.
Yeah, their account of cashing in on that name of Sports Illustrated, it's going to run out pretty soon. Like, there's going to be, the checks are going to start bouncing. I was already I loved Sports Illustrated growing up. I read it every week. I got a subscription for my kids to try to get them to read. But there's nothing in it anymore. Mm-hmm. And whenever I click on Sports Illustrated stories, there's seldom anything worth reading. So I think this is a fundamental journalistic failure. Like, I think transparency is one thing we haven't talked about. This is a huge transparency failure, being clear with your audiences, where you got your information, how you used it, how it was sourced. If you're going to use AI, you need to be upfront about it.
And so here's that other part, too, as we talk about transparency and we talk about best practices in transparency, deleting it. Was that the way to go, or is it maybe more of that traditional editor's note, or explain what happened?
That would be another transparent step, right? When the publisher of New York Times was here at the J School a couple weeks ago, he talked about good news organizations post corrections. It's not the ones that don't make mistakes. It's not that nobody makes mistakes. It's that the ones that own up to it are doing are doing journalistic work by mm-hmm. saying, we made a mistake, accuracy matters to us, so we want to let you know we made a mistake. And that's by hiding it, like Ernest was saying, is it like a second mistake? Like they made an additional, they doubled down on being bad here.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that bothered me about this is you could have been transparent about what you were doing from the beginning, you know, and say, hey, you know, we have this information, we have this technology, we're utilizing this technology because we want to get this information out to you.
And here are the situations in which mm-hmm. we're using it. I mean, one right. of the core examples that was used in this piece from Futurism was about reviews of volleyballs that were being used and where and when and how different brands of volleyballs performed and which one you may want to buy. And it, again, had affiliate links as well so that there was another mm-hmm. means of mm-hmm. revenue generating there. But say up front, you know, that this is about, you know, created through AI and the reviews are actually the result of scraping and curating different product reviews from Amazon or different user reviews on different websites to arrive at the review that was here. This isn't about, in you know, the food world, a test kitchen type right. of a review.
Right, right.
The AP has, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, no.
The AP has an entire website about how they use AI. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we could say Sports Illustrated, you know, is just a victim of journalism hasn't decided what its standards are for AI, like how they're gonna be transparent. But there wasn't an attempt here. There was an attempt to lie and deceive. So
that's right.
It's not like they tried and experimented with the ethics of it right. and it came up short on this attempt. The attempt wasn't made to be transparent and to follow journalistic guidelines using AI.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So we can talk about what's ethical and what's not, and we should also talk about what's legal. We are flying that plane while we're building it, and at the center of the latest decision, comedian Sarah Silverman. Jared, tell us about the case that was going on there.
Sarah Silverman is making a claim that actually some news organizations have made a similar claim that the AI that is like, so the AI is being trained, right? And so these, like ChatGPT, these models are being trained. And so she's saying the content that is being put into the model is violating the copyright. Like a lot of people automatically think the content's being produced by the model. Like what we see when we ask it to do something, that's one concern. But on the other dimension is how are you training this? They're funneling copyrighted material into the back end and teaching the machine how to do things and what it knows. That's what her claim is that the content that's being used to train the AI is not being permissioned and is being used for profit without their permission.
Well, and so the judge in this case issued a decision, an opinion,
yeah.
and didn't come out so hot for Sarah Silverman.
He said hard no on that, yeah. And so, I mean, we can continue to wait for this to develop, but so far the answer has been, you cannot succeed in a copyright claim on that back end of the training.
Okay.
Because the link between the copyrighted material's use and the output that it comes out is not clear enough. Of course, most of these tools are free or very inexpensive right now. That's not going to stay forever. Mm-hmm. It's not out of the goodness of OpenAI's heart that they're letting us experiment with ChatGPT right now.
Yeah.
They're helping. We are training the model too on the front end.
Right.
And they want us to train it for them, and then they're going to start selling it somehow in different ways. And so eventually there will be profit from the copyright material that comes into the back end. You could argue it's a fair use, but the judge didn't really even get that far. He didn't get into the weeds.
What would that argument be on the fair use?
That the content is being repurposed and transformed.
Okay,
that
so it becomes a transformative use.
Use is probably the best argument. I'm going through the four-part fair use test, okay. which I was just prepping for my undergraduate class.
Oh, well, there you go.
Happens to be on
so
the top.
So for our audience, the four parts are.
Oh, okay,
okay.
Let's do this.
I can do it. Okay.
How much of the work did you take?
Okay.
Was it a large percentage, the crucial part, or not? What is the nature of the work that you're taking? Is it a work of fiction, like a Harry Potter book?
Okay.
Or is it like a reference work, like okay. a textbook or okay. something that's meant to be referred to? What is the nature of your use of the work? Okay. Are you using it for commercial purposes or for educational purposes? That's an interesting one for this case. And the last one is, will it hurt the economic viability of the copyright holder to have this competing use?
And this is what Sarah Silverman was. Mm-hmm. It was basically, it's hurting her because it's taking her intellectual property, repurposing it and putting it out and basically training ChatGPT.
Right, they're going to profit from her ideas, but in such an indirect way that it makes it, this is a new copyright question. We don't have this, what is the analog version of this question?
I don't know, you tell me.
I don't know, like we don't have an instance in the past. I mean, okay, if you're saying we're educating the tool,
yeah.
Okay, well, people have been educated by copyright material forever. That's, none of us could do our job without it. And so fair use operates in my classroom every day. And so you could argue it's a fair use because I'm using copyright material to train this time a human, mm-hmm. not a machine. Mm-hmm. But humans and OpenAI are not exactly the same. So I don't know.
I don't think not.
No. So you had shared when I kind of sent out the rundown for our program, you had shared, and I'm going to, okay, the last time, for anybody who hasn't seen Jared on the program, the last time he was here, he made all kinds of Taylor Swift references that students had to explain to me because I'm so uncool that I didn't know them. So he made another reference, and I am going to introduce his reference by going even with a deeper cut and say that this had to do with an artist who was one of my favorites and played Jimmy on Degrassi, Aubrey Graham, better known to the rest of the world today as...
Is it Drake?
It's Drake!
I didn't watch Degrassi. I don't know.
I have a thing for Canadian media.
Okay.
So there you go. So he, in his preteen and teen years. But today, Drake is also in the center of this with copyrighted material.
Yeah, Drake is... I don't think it's through any work of his own, and I don't know if it's commentary on his work or not, but okay. He was the sort of the victim of the first AI song that mm-hmm. completely ripped off an artist's style. So his music, there's an entire song, it's called Heart on My Sleeve, that is generated using AI that sounds okay. exactly like Drake. And so there's questions about copyright there too.
Okay.
And I... Just the rest of the story for my class, we were talking about copyright like we just were, right. And I asked ChatGPT to write a Drake-themed song about copyright, and I sent it to Amy. It nailed it. It was very okay. educational. I went through and highlighted for my students all the concepts that it successfully incorporated into it, and it did it in 10 seconds.
That's impressive.
Four verses and a bridge, 10 seconds.
There you go. I bet you they can study for the final using that. One of the coolest things about having you here with us is that we get to get all law geeky in ways that that's because you've got such a deeper understanding of this than we do.
Yeah,
right?
We're out of our field.
We're not lawyers and we don't play them on TV. Like, we haven't made careers out of scholarship in this area. But there is another issue that's popping up across the country that I do want to get your take on, and it has to do with police scanners. Ernest and I can tell you that from our time in the newsroom covering Spot News, the police scanners, it's that tuner that lets you listen in on police radios, they can be the reporter's first tip about fires or crashes or crimes in progress. Well, there are some technological changes to those radios that are giving police departments the ability to encode these communications and block them from scanners so that people like you and me, we can't listen to them anymore. So let's start by talking about how this works in the first place, because in the US, we can listen to police mm-hmm. radios. A yes. lot of other countries I have gone and taught in or worked with journalists, and I've, you know, compared X, formerly known as Twitter, to being like a police scanner and listening to it, that everything needs to be verified. And they look at me like I'm crazy because police scanners and the airwaves are not public right. in some of those countries. So they've never listened to a police scanner. Explain for a minute, under our current broadcasting laws, who owns the airwaves and why it is we are able to listen to them.
We all own the public airwaves. It might not feel like it, but we do. And so because there's spectrum scarcity, there's only so many frequencies that sound or TV also can travel. Mm-hmm. The government has regulated at the request of the broadcast industry, which is very rare. They asked to be regulated. And so there's a section of the band that is set aside for things like police scanners, that anybody can listen to that band. Other people can also participate. It's not the police band. It's the reason they're scanning. The police scanners are scanning frequencies. They're going through a repeat cycle. It's the soundtrack of any newsroom, right?
It is.
Yeah.
Like, some people fall asleep to ocean sounds.
Right.
We fall asleep to police scanners. Oh, yeah, I did.
With the
until somebody leaves the key open, and then you just hear this loud pitch noise.
And everybody, and like, who stopped the scanner? Because sometimes people stop it on one frequency. Yeah. So anyway, that's what's happening is they're scanning the public airwaves.
Yeah. So with this change in the technology, there is this possibility that they could go away, the ability to listen to them right. to go away. What is lost in that? Apart from people like looky-loos like me who right. are just listening in every time a fire truck goes by my living room window.
Right, but here's the thing. This yeah. isn't anything new. I mean, there have been attempts by police departments going all the way back when I was in, 30 years ago, when I was in newsroom, basically that was my... That's all I did.
The soundtrack of my life, pretty much.
And there were attempts at that during that time, back in the 1990s, to put police on a certain frequency that only they would use, and that was their way of saying, "Well, we need to do this because of various situations, like someone being able to get on that frequency and hold it open to the point where we can't communicate." And so police have always, under various scenarios, mm-hmm. tried to have a certain frequency. And there are federal agencies that do have certain frequencies that only they operate on. So again, this isn't anything new, but I think in terms of them wanting to have this sort of only we can access mm-hmm. kind of frequency. I think where this is new is that now they have the technology in which to do it, and they've come up with new ways to justify by basically saying, we're doing this in the public interest. We're doing this as a safety measure because technology is so widespread, and the ability to be able to block certain frequencies and that sort of thing, it becomes a public safety issue.
Help me understand that argument, though. Like, this goes back to that whole, what do they accomplish? What is that public safety issue that they're solving by preventing me from being able to listen to it after I see 17 police cars go by?
Well, and this is one of the issues. This is why the New York Safety Commission yeah. is basically saying, no, we need to have some hearings. You need to explain to us why you need to go and use this new technology, because right now you're saying this, but we're not sure you're being as transparent as you need to be in order to explain why you need this technology, because we're getting ready to spend $500 million to basically wall off police mm-hmm. communication.
Well, and I may be falling down a rabbit hole, and we're actually going to talk in a minute about the Washington Post coverage about gun violence and imagery, but I think too about some of the cases that listening to some of that radio traffic has actually painted a much clearer picture about what ultimately went on in that moment. I think about Laquan McDonald and the 16 shots in Chicago. That in some ways, police scanner traffic from a transparency mm-hmm. standpoint is the audio, the oral version of the body cam footage.
Right.
I don't know, maybe that's me making a connection
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I remember when a lot of the, you would have I'm just thinking about the George Floyd yeah. and the video of that uh-huh. and how it was instantaneous. Philando Castile, where you had it on Facebook Live. That, you had those things happening, but then people were saying, but wait a minute, we need to have the fuller context. But that meant that you needed to have the body cam video from the police officers, but it took you a while to get that, okay? And I think that's where people are concerned when it comes to this. People will still be able to access it, but they're going to have to go through those same sort of principles as the body cam in order to get what was the police communication that was happening. Whereas currently, the use of scanners, you hear it in real time.
It puts a gatekeeper between the public and what the public officials are doing.
Right, exactly.
I mean, one of the big arguments for open government is that people act differently when they know they're being watched. Mm-hmm. So when people are in the scanner and they know that they can be heard, they might act differently than if they know that they're in a safe space and they can say whatever they want. Of course, the technology for them to avoid the public has been there for decades. I'm surprised. I mean, this is a more advanced version of that.
Yeah.
But they could always just get on their cell phone and avoid the scanner.
Right. And many of them are.
Yeah, and use the apps like Telegraph or whatever, Signal, yeah. to get around all of that.
But part of the problem with that is, can that hold up in a court of law? If you're using your cell, they're going, wait a minute, why didn't you use, is that proper police procedure?
Mm-hmm, there you go.
You weren't following proper police procedure, therefore you're in violation of these particular statutes, which opens you mm-hmm. up uh-huh. to either criminal or civil uh-huh. liability.
That's fair. That's a good point.
Yeah, I could talk about this one forever, but we don't have that much time. I was checking my email pretty sparingly last week, but several people sent me the latest installment of the Washington Post groundbreaking reporting, which is an in-depth immersive project on the impact of mass shootings in America. This installment is called Terror on Repeat and focuses almost entirely on the photos and images of the aftermath of AR-15 use. And there's been some pretty mixed reaction about the publishing of this piece. And the question as to whether the images were too graphic, too violent, to the point where they were gratuitous. But, you know, there's a whole other camp out there that's saying we have to bear witness, and that's our job as journalists, is to make sure that the world is bearing witness, not to sanitize it.
Well, that camp's been out there for a long time. Mm-hmm. It was there when I was in newsrooms, and I'm sure it was there when you were. I can't tell you how often I was in conversations with editors, with photo editors, with photographers about what we will and what we won't publish when it comes to the aftermath of violence.
Mm-hmm. And covering the beat you were on, probably more than...
Right, absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things that was almost sacrosanct was that if it's a kid, that's not happening. It is just not, we are not going to publish anything visual as it relates to something horrific happened to a child, whether you're talking about violence or whether you're talking about an accident. Mm-hmm. It is just not gonna happen. So when I saw this come out, I saw it that when it came out that Sunday morning in mm-hmm. the Washington Post mm-hmm. online, and I was like, whoa, they took a huge step. I mean, they literally were showing things that I just had never seen, and I'd seen personally,
right,
as a reporter, but never seen in print,
never seen in pixel,
right,
never seen on video.
Absolutely. I mean, I knew photographers who had the photos and would never even put them on the desk. Yeah. For editing,
because you take the photo and decide later.
Right, absolutely. So this was huge. And the question becomes to me: the question goes back to, is this going to further the conversation about mass shootings and gun violence in the United States? And one of the articles we have on our links blog talks about the fact that many of our publications here have no problem in showing that as it relates internationally. But when it comes to domestically, they just will not do it until now. The question becomes, will the rest of the news media pick up on this as a way to say, this is the reality of mass shootings, this is the reality of gun violence in the United States? I'm not sure. I don't know whether that's going to be the case. And what kind of impact it would have.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I've heard more discussion about the choosing to publish these images than I've heard about the issue itself. That in a lot of ways, this became more about whether or not we should publish it and not whether or not it's going to have an impact and how we make headway on the problem of mass shootings and assault rifles.
Right.
Before we go today, I want to take a few minutes to remember former First Lady Rosalynn Carter. She is in her final resting place today in Plains, Georgia. The Carters' post-presidential era has been so impactful. Most know them for their Habitat for Humanity work. And a little bit more under the radar is the Carter Center and what it has done to support journalism, and specifically journalists who either experience trauma or are covering traumatic events. And a big part of her legacy will be how she has shaped coverage of mental health here in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, early on, when she was First Lady, she was introduced mm-hmm. the issues around mental health on a national scale through her platform as the First Lady. And then once they opened the Carter Center, one of the first things she did was basically to create a mental health program. And part of that program was a journalism fellows program in which journalists who are, like you said, were either covering mental health or had some issues involving mental health of their own mm-hmm. were basically supported by her foundation, by the Carter Center Foundation, and they've gone on to do amazing work as it relates to mental health, not just in the United States, but around the world, but particularly in UAE countries.
Hmm. There's another part, and I want to credit our colleague Ron Kelly for this. He brought it up to me yesterday, and we just kind of had this conversation about it. Another part, and that is part of what we were talking about, that she did a lot of things as First Lady that, as we look a couple decades down the line, Hillary Clinton tried to do a lot of the same things, but Rosalynn Carter was successful in doing them, whereas Hillary Clinton drew a lot of criticism and a lot of rebuke. And we started talking about this for a second, and we're debating a little bit what the role of journalists was in that, looking at the development during the Clinton administration of the 24-hour news cycle, that Rosalynn Carter was able to do a lot more of this work under the radar because there was less news inventory to have to fill.
Yeah, I would say she did. She did. She was able to get away, not get away. She was able to successfully accomplish and successfully be able to promote certain things. But if you go back, Lady Bird Johnson was able to do the same thing. If you go back, Pat Nixon was able to do certain things. And even Nancy Reagan was able to do certain things.
Just say no.
I mean, you can.
Today we may question the efficacy of that.
But
in its time.
I mean, they all had an impact. Yeah. But you didn't have that 24-hour news cycle, and you didn't have the scrutiny. That didn't happen until you got to Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton's first administration.
And we were talking about that, and the idea that, like, in the aftermath of the Gulf War, at which point the Clintons enter the White House in 1993 in January, and then we have the Fox News generation born during that administration.
Right.
And a whole new level of partisan scrutiny.
Right, right. I mean, you also have to factor in that Bill Clinton appointed her as head of the first healthcare initiative. And then that's when, you know, you had the partisan politics and the 24-hour news cycle. It sort of all came together to say, you know, wait a minute, you appointed the first lady, but she wasn't elected, you were elected. And then, boom, it took off. And then there you go. And from that point on, whatever role the first lady took on was going to be scrutinized based on what happened during those first few weeks of the Clinton administration in 1993.
Fascinating.
Yep.
And again, these are the types of conversations we're having every day in the hallways here at the Missouri School of Journalism. We're actually almost out of time for today, so I would like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. There's a lot more that you can read about each of the topics we talked about today. There are columns, especially appreciations from journalists about the work that they were able to accomplish because of their personal ties with the Carter Center. Those are on our links blog, and you can find that under both the programs and the podcast tabs at kbia.org. That site is a great place to visit whenever you want to watch or listen to our program again, see what we'll talk about next time. You can also subscribe to our podcast feeds. You can get it there. You can get it on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher. We invite you to like us on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to see what we will be talking about next week as well. We expect Kathy Kiley to be back with us at that time. I'd like to thank RJI's Travis McMillan for directing the show, Takiya Thomas for handling the audio, Tim Pilcher composed our theme music, and Nate Brown is our social media manager. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you next week.